Welcome to Change Hackers, providing daily insight and inspiration for people changing their world. I'm your host, Tony Cook, and I invite you to join me today in conversation with someone on the front line of driving change and transformation. My guest today is Genevieve Boast. Jen is the founder of Beyond Human Stories, a global consultancy that exists to connect individuals and organizations to their biggest social purpose and story in the world. She works with leaders and teams in business, education, charities, and communities to create new stories that are authentic, coherent, and inspire evolution and resilience in a constantly changing world. Jen's an experienced and somewhat exotic coach, facilitator, and trainer, with her methods spanning a range of disciplines, including NLP, continuous improvement, leadership development, and indigenous nature-based initiation practices. I spoke to Jen online from her home in Wiltshire, UK. So Genevieve, welcome to Change Hackers.
Thank you, Tony.
How best to describe you, really? You're a storyteller like no other, in the sense that you not so much tell stories as we would normally think of it, as a, you know, kind of fiction or whatever. Your focus is entirely around people's stories. Right. And helping people to make sense of their own story, both looking back and looking forward, to get a sense of who we are. Right. And that starts with you. Exactly. Right? So exactly. Where's the fascination in this come from in you?
Well, do you know, it's funny. So I often sort of people go, "Oh, you're a storyteller. Can you tell me a good story?"
Like, well, right, actually, exactly.
I prefer to describe it as the work I do is story making, because I actually think the biggest story is the grand adventure of our lives. And in our society currently, maybe this is my jaded nature, having been in media for over a decade now, mainstream media, which of course is the story making engine of our culture, you know, actually we're led to think that the adventures and heroics and you know, epic tales and legacies are by other people in other times or outside of ourselves. And of course, you know, every hero starts within, and every one of us has this unique adventure of a lifetime that we're here to live, I believe. And so, you know, my fascination with this, I guess, began when I was very small. And, you know, I started off life as a wild mountain child in the Rocky Mountains of Colorado, and used to just run all day in the wilderness and tell myself stories and talk to the trees and talk to the plants. And, you know, for me, there was no distinction between a human friend and a rock friend. It was my reality. When I was six, we moved to Cambridge in England. And that was a culture shock and a story shock like no other, because all of a sudden I was dropped within what I felt was a very restrictive, confining academic narrative that said the only reality is one that's scientific, can be measured, life is inanimate, the only intelligence is human, and in fact, even then, the only intelligence is our IQ, all these other forms of intelligence, which thankfully we now really know exist, such as our emotional intelligence, our spiritual intelligence, you know, our instinct, all of these things, they're not real. They're not real unless you can measure them. And I guess this was my early sense of rebellion, and yet all of the what I knew to be true on a very deep instinctive level was so counter to the story I was being fed, whether that was from my parents who were working in the Cambridge University system, or my teachers, or my friends around me, you know, even young as they were, had enchantment and magic kind of beaten out of them. And it was only real in Hollywood and Disney films. You know, that was my first form of rebellion, was to, when I felt lost and confused by this story, was I would go out into nature and I would run in circles and I'd tell myself stories. And of course, the stories were about my life and how I wanted my life to be. I wouldn't have known it at age 7 or 8, but that was me setting intentions for what was to come and for the work I now do with people from all over the world. You know, this sense of inviting us into the human adventure of our times opposed to something more traditional and stereotypical like the hero's journey, which serves a purpose in as far as it brings inspiration. But I think it also can be very disempowering in that we are constantly looking for solutions and inspiration outside of ourselves. You know, we live in a culture of the silver bullet where we think, you know, if we just get that job or that pay rise or that beautiful partner, or we just move to the place where we're going to be happy, you know, everything will be fine. And the reality is it doesn't quite work like that. And the only thing that can make our life beautiful and vibrant is the choices that we make from a place of real authenticity. And so I find myself saying a lot lately, authenticity is the ultimate rebellion, and it's also the ultimate process towards making stories of change, positive change in the world around us, both for ourselves and for everybody else.
How unhelpful do you think it is that, you know, to take this story making metaphor, if you like, for each of us individually? You know, we're all the protagonist in our own story.
Yeah, right.
The pressure people feel to conform to a heroic archetype.
Right. I know. I do, you know, it's funny. I look around and, oh man, it's the archetype of the hero is an interesting one right now, because, you know, if I look at some of the elders, so I do a lot of work with Indigenous communities and elders, and they have, I guess, what we would call a kind of more stereotypical archaic hero narrative, where it's all around power in the community and power on the basis of my experience, of my age, of my wisdom, you know. And there's nothing wrong with that, but equally it creates a very hierarchical structure which can be very restrictive in many ways. Or I look at the work I do with younger people who, you know, for them the hero archetype shows up in the form of celebrityism and focus on these charismatic hero leaders, if you want to call them that, you know, in whatever sector of society, where actually it's very disempowering, because me, the normal everyday person, is never good enough by comparison to whoever I'm projecting that hero onto, you know. And right. So that subtly brings in something I think all of my work in change hacking and story hacking goes into disrupting, which is the story of the victim. And the story of the victim is underpinned by, I'm not good enough as I am. I'm not wise enough, old enough, rich enough, pretty enough, talented enough. You know, the enoughs go on in infinitely. And so I think if we can hack that story of the victim and realize that we all have these unique gifts waiting to be discovered and waiting to be given, I think we get back to the purity of the hero's journey, which, you know, Joseph Campbell brought to the world back in the 1940s, 50s, which, you know, really is about our unique human adventure and how that adventure moves us from a story of me and really understanding who me is in the world of distractions and other people's narratives, and moving through this metamorphosis point into a bigger story of we, where, you know, me is one beautiful human thread in the tapestry of our mythology on Earth right now. And, you know, I was having a conversation with someone last week, another female colleague, actually. We were saying, you know, as women particularly, we have never been so free in some aspects. You know, we've never had as much power to go out there and do what it is we wish to do, to give our gifts, particularly in the Western world. And yet a lot of the women and men I end up working with in the Western world have also equally never felt so disempowered and so much a victim of the system of success in whatever way that is, you know. So one of the programs I run for people is called Successful But ... And usually you can fill that in with whatever you wish, but usually it's successful but miserable. Because we're not showing up authentically, we're not living our purpose, we're not living lives of meaning or excitement or inspiration. We're simply getting through day to day based on obligation and duty and what we've been told should make us happy and fulfilled, but rarely does, you know. So I think when we can turn that hero archetype within and own that ourselves, rather than looking outwards, we're looking inwards, then it can become very empowering. But to do so means you have to drop a lot of the social stories that we've been taught to wear and take off a lot of masks to really get to a point of being comfortable in your own skin.
And that's really difficult for people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. Absolutely. You know, and you and I have, well, we were talking just before this podcast, you know, you and I have both been through that in various different forms. And I know in my teenage years, I won't go into the various different stories, but, you know, my rebellion in my teens was very destructive, you know, and the ironic thing about that is, of course, rebelling against what I thought was the story of conformity. Of course, I conformed to a similar narrative of the rebel without a cause. You know, how long has that been around as an archetype, right? And it's because I was rebelling for me. I was just rebelling because I could, because it was my only way of getting power in a system that felt very disempowered.
It's a form of control.
Absolutely, you know. And so it's funny, as a rebel in that sense, we become the very thing we hate. So actually, you know, it was only when I moved into through several experiences in my early business career, through whistleblowing being one of them, through dark nights of the soul and near on nervous breakdowns being another, and into more, I guess, serving forms of work, such as CSR and community investment, and then later on into being a change consultant in various different worlds, that actually my rebellion became on behalf of something bigger than myself. It became on behalf of a much wider group of people and a much more empowering social story that I feel is really breaking through now in the world in many different forms. And that's when I think rebellion becomes very powerful, because you're no longer looking at it from what am I personally going to get from this act. You're looking at it more from what can I give to give people a voice, to give people a sense of personal power and personal choice. And I think that's where real change hacking begins.
I think it's interesting you mention that, because the word is loaded in the first place, isn't
right.
it? Rebellion, you know, it carries connotations of being destructive and unhelpful. And certainly threatening to the status quo. And at the heart of it, there is, for anyone who's rebellious in any way, whether it's extreme forms or very subtle or very productive, constructive forms of rebellion, you know, at the heart of it, there's this dissatisfaction with the status quo. There's just, I guess, there's, certainly in your life so far, there's been a very strong arc in there of rebellion, but it's gone from being untempered and destructive, not just to others, but to yourself.
Right.
And as gradually you've learned to channel it in a more positive way, in a way that's more extrinsic.
Right.
You know, it's reflecting out of you through love and compassion to others.
Right.
How have you learned to do that?
Well, it's interesting. You know, it was actually something that only occurred to me today as we were talking. You know, if I think back to the very destructive forms of rebellion, particularly in my teenage years, and, you know, the pivotal catalyst moments. So, you know, there was a moment when I was 17 where I was arrested, and I was sat in a police cell. And I was freaked out and angry and, you know, all of the things that we feel when we feel we're caged in and trapped by a story we don't like. And of course, we've co-created that story, right? So it was my choices that led me to that place, mm-hmm. as well as the system I was rebelling against. But, you know, the thing that absolutely hacked my behavior then and forever since then was a very, very kind policeman coming into my cell and sitting next to me. And simply turning to me and saying, Jen, you're worth so much more than this, you know? And those simple words and that very simple moment, you know, that man didn't have to do that. That man could have written me off as just another teenage rebel who was involved in petty crime. That man could have judged me and done a whole, you know, raft of other things that we do every day as humans, but he didn't. He chose to come in and show love. And so the epiphany I had today when you and I were talking was, whoa, like every time I've really created powerful change, it's been in an act of love. actually, you know. So years later, after I'd left my mainstream corporate job and was consulting in the third sector, I found myself in a youth offending institute with a group of, you know, 20 odd young men inside for various different things. And, you know, I found myself telling them that story. And actually, really, instead of me judging them and labeling them and, you know, being fearful of them, which I know a lot of people who do that kind of work are, that was just such a unique session, because I then showed them love, not the sort of love that they'd ever been exposed to, you know, kind of the distorted male-female love that we have, whether it's from parents or whether from partners and girlfriends and boyfriends, but almost this universal kind of love and compassion and empathy, which doesn't judge someone by their surface story. It actually looks straight into the whites of their eyes and sees them as the hero within, I guess, you know, the human hero within. And I actually ended up doing yoga with them.
And I ended up
And I ended up getting them to write poetry and raps and share stories about moments where they had been resilient and they had been shown love in an unexpected way. And that created a real sense of humanity and a real sense of me too and connection, you know, between us all. It was just one of those really deeply normal moments of magic. No.
Had you planned to use their workshop that way?
Nope, not at all. And it was
you
one of
those. You just went ones. With the flow.
Absolutely, because that's what was needed and that's what was being called for to create that sense of connection. And so towards the end of that session, which had gone completely not to plan, but was really powerful, the alarm went off in the prison. And usually what happens is, you know, all of the prisoners are put back in their cells and everyone goes into lockdown because it's usually a fights happening somewhere. And and you know, the guards went to do this with the young men, and one of the ringleaders, who had been somewhat challenging up until, you know, midway through the session, when suddenly he melted and just really started sharing some personal stuff, stopped and said, actually, can we all stay in here? And the guard said, why? And they said, because we want to stay and protect Miss. Referring to me as Miss. And I, you know, and the guards looked at me and said, are you all right with that? And I'm like, I am more than all right with that. You know, I just felt this deep sense of honor. And, you know, it just took my breath away that in a space of 45 minutes of that session, through the sharing of our stories and that me sharing vulnerable love, I guess, with this group of young men, we had turned from them judging me as some successful businesswoman who was going to come in and tell them a whole load of stuff they didn't want to know about and judge them, to this real sense of connection and empathy and love and humanity. So I think that's the power of story for me. That's the power of story making as opposed to storytelling. Because when we're making stories with other people, anything we share is coming from this place of service. It's coming as an offering that's going to shift everyone. It's not coming from a place of narcissistic need to be heard and recognized and respected or whatever that is. It's coming from somewhere deeper than that. And, you know, I've had lots and lots of examples of where those Me Too moments of shared humanity shift people's lives in ways that we, you know, we may never know what's happened to those young men. And yet years down the line, I still get contacted by people from sessions like that who, you know, this morning, a young person emailed me and said, I was just thinking about our session today and I wanted to tell you how that still stays with me. So stories create these memories that then create future change years and years down the line. And we, as the story holders, makers, tellers, we will probably never know the vast ripple effect of that in the world, but we have to trust and surrender to the flow of whatever's coming through in that moment.
So there's something about intentionality there, and where you're, insofar as where you're coming from, you know, and this whole business about, you know, offering to other people or being in service of other people, or coming from a place of compassion and love, looking for the good in people.
Right.
You know, it is so important, you know, given the alternative of, you know, not being able to see past the surface story and, you know, kind of stereotyping or making assumptions about people.
Right.
And I've seen that myself as well. I used to work in prisons some years ago, and one of the most profound activities for rehabilitation was a working restaurant in the prison. Mm. Current serving offenders were working in the kitchen, handling knives, trusted to handle knives,
right?
You know, and then were out front at front of house serving paying guests, yeah, and interacting with them, who treated them like any other person, you know, normal, you know, didn't label them as an offender, and it had such an effect on people's self identity,
right,
and respect for self.
Right.
Because others were from this point of compassion.
Exactly.
And wanting to be part of their journey and helping them to heal.
Well, and I think, you know, this also applies, this whole principle applies in almost every setting, but, you know, particularly in organizations. So you and I do a lot of work in business and organizations, and you know, the idea of remembering, reconnecting, restoring, you know, our sense of authentic purpose and identity. The word re, I talk about this a lot. Mm. The word re implies that it's something we already have within us. It's not a model, a technique, a how-to that we're going to learn from anywhere else. I mean, those are helpful and can point the way, but it's something my grandfather used to talk about a lot when he was a management consultant. It's not about the how-tos, it's about the who-tos. So in organizations, you know, similar transformations happen when we move beyond the mask or the label of someone's role or title or department or, you know, who we think they are, and actually move around that to see the real human that sits behind that. And, you know, powerful, powerful things can happen in teams when everybody starts to drop their judgments and projections and actually really start to listen and see others through this lens of everybody has a gift to bring to this. Now, that's very easy to say and not so easy to do. And there are ways of actually bringing people into that deeper sense of personal and collective narratives. But, you know, it takes a degree of self-awareness, as you and I were both saying earlier. It takes a degree of humility, actually, to surrender being right and having to always be the one who knows the answers. There's this real vast open space beyond our stories when we don't know what we're going to say. We don't know the answer. We don't know what we're going to collectively come up with. And that's where the well of human co-creativity comes from, you know, which is, I think, the space that personally is, you know, running an organization that's called Beyond Human Stories. That's the juicy space that I love to get people into again and again and create really powerful, lasting change. It's the space beyond who we think we are, what we think we're here to do. It's that, you know, that place of limitless potential where something deeper can flow through everybody.
But implicit in that is a degree of stability in a team, because it takes time to build that level of knowledge of each other, and trust and love and so on, which can be very then threatening and to outsiders coming in, you know, new hires, new starts joining the team.
It's a yes and would be my response to that, because you're absolutely right. Yes, you know, trust and intimacy and humanity, vulnerability actually is what we're talking about here. Yes. When we're talking about showing real and raw and taking our truth to the best of our abilities. Absolutely agree with you. And my build on that is, I have had some magical moments in organizations, you know, with difficult leaders, shall we say, where actually I've had a very historically difficult relationship, and yet chosen in these pivotal moments to put all of that to one side, to drop my own defenses and my own stories about that person and just show real humanity. You know, and what I find is, you know, whether you're a newcomer coming into the team, whether you're a consultant, which is the role I often find myself in, or a coach, or whether you're someone who's been in a team for a very long time, if you show up with integrity and honesty and authenticity to the best of your abilities again and again and again, that shift can happen very quickly. So last week, you know, I was in the woods with a shared friend of ours, Giles Hutchins, mm-hmm. with a group of 8 strangers, pretty much. And none of us knew each other from that sense. And you all come into the room in the morning looking at each other with difference on, you know, it's like, oh, I wonder who you are. I wonder what you've been doing. I wonder, you know, but you see each other as different. And yet within the first couple of hours, having just walked over to the woods and sat and built a fire together, people were sharing the most incredibly deep and vulnerable narratives. People were crying. Other people were feeling that authenticity and sharing their own by response. And by the end of the day, it felt like we had known each other for years. Mm. And so I think, you know, it's both. You're absolutely right in that, you know, that kind of level of trust in an organization does take time and deepens over time. But equally, there is these very quick hacks, which actually come when we're being very honest and raw and vulnerable, that actually can bypass all of that and create intimacy very quickly.
And you can show leadership in that from anywhere in the organization. It's not something that's solely the responsibility of the leader, the most senior person in the room. Important though that is for them to sort of signal and give permission, because others are looking for it.
Yes.
To some extent, for that kind of behavior, that kind of openness and vulnerability. But the lead could come from anywhere, literally.
Absolutely.
You don't have to wait for that permission, really, from elsewhere.
No, and do you know what? When I did work in corporate full time, it used to be one of my acts of mischief, actually, to show deep humanity and compassion. Mm. So I know in one department I worked in, our VP was known for her outbursts and her temper tantrums and being very, very hierarchical and old school. And no one would want to go into her office when she was having one of those days. Everybody would try and nudge each other to get them to go in there. And, you know, it was one of my acts of loving mischief, I called it, to when, you know, I'd wait for the moment where she was at her worst, in a sense. And, you know, you'd feel that because that was coming from stress, that was coming from anxiety, that was coming from fear. And I would do something so simple to hack the process, which is just literally go in and bring a cup of tea unannounced and put it on her desk without saying a word and walk out. You know, and even if it wasn't in the moment that she would turn around, later she'd come over and say, do you know what? Thank you. Like, thank you so much. I just needed that hack.
Disarming.
Absolutely. Yeah. You know, so I think we can make new stories through love in whatever context we find ourselves in, through feeling our shared humanity and feeling, you know, just how tough it can be living in these times we live in right now. You know, I mean, there's perceived confusion and chaos and stress and anxiety everywhere we look. Yet equally in that moment, we all have a choice as to how we're going to respond to that. And it sounds really trite to say fear or love, and I don't think it is quite that simple, but we can choose to respond increasingly from a place of shared humanity, you know, and compassion and creating connections as opposed to creating separations.
Well, there is a kind of a deep-seated dualism around this, isn't there? I mean, I think it was Freud who, you know, pointed to sort of pain and pleasure. You know, we run away from one and towards the other. And you know, there's the adrenaline kind of reflex as well, isn't there? The fight or flight kind of stuff. But the bravery required to be authentic, mm-hmm. You know, is a tricky one for a lot of people. But you know, to your point around the kind of the flux around us, you know, this accelerating pace of change and lack of certainty and all the rest of it that so many other people talk about, and I don't want to get into that really, but it's more about the centering of yourself in it, you know, keeping yourself steadfast within this chaos going on around you, and the role of personal narrative.
Yes.
You know, and sense making of who you are and what is authentic to you becomes so important. Yeah. And I guess that brings us on to your book, Tough Bliss, which you brought out a couple of months ago, which I understand started as a cathartic process for you? It was less about publishing. It was more about what you'd learn about yourself as you wrote it.
It did. It was very funny, actually. And it's now a process, of course. I truly believe nothing happens by accident. Nothing is wasted. Even if we can't see why we're doing something in the moment, it always in the future, we're able to look back and join the dots, you know? So I do remember I was doing a lot of speaking, maybe 7-8 years ago when I first left to become a consultant. And I was just sharing personal stories, you know, because I didn't want to stand up there and talk about theory. I wanted to, you know, create connections with people. So I started sharing a number of stories, and always I'd have people come up afterwards going, "Oh my God, that was an incredible story. You've got to share, you've got to write a book. And I was really resistant to that, really resistant, because I think there's way, way, way too many books out there. I think most, particularly personal narratives, were falling into what I was calling a vanity narrative. So a sharing for me, as opposed to a sharing in any way that's useful for people. And so I just didn't want to get on that bandwagon. And yet the messages, I think this is what happens, you know, serendipity, synchronicity, whatever we want to call it, starts giving you these kicks. And if we have the ears to listen and the eyes to see, we start to hear them. And I talk about a lot of my kicks in the book. So I'm very stubborn. I ignore the kicks for a very long time and usually end up learning the hard way. But I had a lot of kicks. So in the end, I acquiesced and I said, all right. I'm going to write the first version as if no one's ever going to read it. I'm going to write my own story. I'm going to retell my mythology. I'm going to restory what my life has meant as a process of almost letting it go and healing and releasing a lot of the old narratives that no longer served me. So I did that. And then, of course, through the first writing, the restory cycle that I use and had been using, but not explicitly, came through. And suddenly I had a structure there. A structure that invites people reading, not just to read my story, but into the center of their unique adventure. Suddenly that felt more purposeful and more useful to be sharing. And so I sat with that for a bit and went, okay, all right. So if I write this second version as if Jen isn't in it, and this is the archetypal human journey through life in our times, what would that look like? And so the second and third and fourth edits all became about really refining the restorying process that I believe we're all individually and collectively going through on the planet right now. That's where, you know, I had experiences later on in the book in the section of Unity, which actually pointed me at the title. It pointed me at this evolutionary story that I believe we're currently in, where we are moving from one of dualism and separation and mechanistic, like machine-like, how the world works, to one that is much more interconnected and one that is more unified, and, you know, one that's now being supported by a whole raft of new science coming out. So that's a world I now work in a lot, is adding scientific credibility to a lot of the inherent mystical insights that I think people are having and have had for many, many years. And so, you know, that's where the book that's now out came from. But it was a process I had to go through so I can now take other people through it, which is almost when we're brave enough to go back to our past and see the gifts to the lessons and the blessings that particularly our tests and challenges have brought to us, we see how perfect our journey has been. And instead of a lot of techniques which kind of tell you to get rid of the past or overcome negative feelings or numb it out or, you know, completely write a new story. My experience is a bit different from that, which is your life and your story is your gift and USP. It's your unique genius that no one else can bring. And so as soon as you connect back into the spark of who you came into this world being, and you see all of the blessings that your testing times have brought you, and the strength you've gained from that, you can step into the second half of the cycle, which actually is a story when we move from the story of me to we, and you can start giving your gifts to the world, whether the world is your family or your community or your workplace or something much bigger than that, or, you know, it doesn't matter. And that's when we become unified, I think, with this incredible time we're living in. In many ways, it is chaotic and very scary. You know, I'd lie. I'm about to release a blog this week, which is all about that. about waking up in the middle of the night, you know, with this existential fear of living through these times. But, you know, actually, that's also part of being human. That's the tough bit. And I think we can't have the bliss and the joy and the connection without feeling the opposite side of those things, you know, and not believe any of them as
the,
true.
Well, right. The closest we get, most of us get to attempting this is writing a CV.
Yeah. Right.
it really is. You know, it's so superficial. It's so airbrushed, and don't we all know it? And the version you've described is probably something that many people do intuitively, but very privately, and it's not expressed. It's not articulated. Yeah. It's not shared with others.
Yeah.
You know, sometimes not even family members. You know, partners.
Yeah.
Let alone people you work with.
Absolutely.
So, you know, there is this courage to do that. I mean, what you're saying, the argument you're making is that taking that step brings tremendous benefits.
Oh my gosh. It's funny. You this is where you transcend the victim story completely. If you have the courage to, because, you know, in many ways it can seem really scary to own that every decision in our life has created the reality we've experienced. And that's very controversial. And I know I get into several, discussions with people around ultimate self-responsibility, but to realize that our choices really do create our reality, whether we're conscious of them or not. And that doesn't mean surprising things don't happen and things we would rather not and things that we haven't planned, but it's that ability to choose how we respond in the moment. And so a lot of my work's around, you know, transcending the victim narrative for good through ultimate responsibility. And I always insert a hyphen in between, the S and the A, which is our ability to respond in the moment. So I talk to, I do a lot of work on in the Native American reservations in the northern US, and on the surface of it, those are incredibly tough environments for a multitude of reasons, which we won't go into now. But, you know, I talk there to my adopted aunts, and they often say to me, you know, when you're so centered in your story, in that sense of being of service to something greater than you, you can be walking through a war zone and be untouchable. You know, you can maintain that sense of calm and peace and, you know, the ability to respond, so that responsibility, no matter what is happening around you. And I think that for me, and I watch them do this, I mean, I watch them do this in a whole raft of really challenging situations. And so that's my role model. You know, that's why I do it. It's this whole ability to be of service no matter what is happening and to claim our ability to respond to whatever is in front of us rather than being a victim of that change. And I guess, you know, when we're talking about change making and change hacking, that really is the shift I think we're seeing on the planet right now, is this really stepping up and having the courage to be authentic and the courage to be express ourselves creatively. And, you know, I do a fair bit of work with millennials in various different forms. And, you know, back to your point about CVs, what I love about that is, of course, the world of work is changing. The world of how we obtain our jobs, our vocational callings, whatever we choose to do is changing. So what I love is, you know, how people are approaching CVs differently these days. And so I know a lot of people are starting to do videos and tell stories and create, you know, these incredible collage books of who they are and really think outside of the traditional story of what that means. And I'm not saying, you know, your typical C-suite post would go for that. I don't know, depend on the company. But there isn't a much more authentic storytelling coming out in a lot of arenas around this. And I guess in a way it's a bit of a backlash to some of the facade of social media, where actually, you know, there's the story that we want people to see as opposed to the real, raw, vulnerable, honest story that's going on. So I think that's just an interesting trend to watch in some of the younger generations now, which is, yes, there's still a lot of pretense and masks and things like that. But equally, there's a lot of creativity and a lot of rebellion. Back to that word again, rebelling from those kind of more traditional structures to be more honest and authentic in the world. And I guess it's the sense of what have I got to lose when they look around and see old traditional structures definitely shifting and changing, but particularly, you know, in some cases crumbling. You know, why wouldn't I go out there and be who I am? You know, so I get filled with hope. And I work with some of the younger generations now who are much less fearful than I was at their age.
Yeah. On the off chance that Reid Hoffman is listening to this podcast, let's hope he is. He might find it one day. What would your message be to him in terms of the hacks that you'd like to see happen around LinkedIn that give us a more rounded sense of the individual?
Oh, wow. I know. LinkedIn's a fun one. I mean, do you know? I've actually seen some really authentic LinkedIn profiles and groups lately. And again, I get really excited by that. And I think, you know, I wouldn't say necessarily it's the platform itself, because I think the platform is what it is. It's more how and who, you know, we choose to present ourselves and how we choose to engage with it. So, you know, I know my weekly story hacks go out on LinkedIn and they're very authentic, you know. So even, I can't remember who it was, what famous writer said, if you're not a little bit scared before you publish something, you know, you're not really publishing something of value because it's still sanitized. Some of the story hacks I send out on a weekly basis and I put on LinkedIn, I have a bit of a gulp moment about, thinking, oh my God, what are people going to think of this one? But for me, that's a healthy sign of being real. So I think it's how we create conversations on there, you know?
Yeah, now you say that, I see it. And it's only just become conscious as a pattern. And there seems to have been a sort of a convergence between in terms of people's use of the platform rather than its functionality, you know, what it's capable of doing. And if you compare people's use of, say, Facebook to LinkedIn, even going back 2 or 3 years, there seemed to be a very clear division in terms of, you know, your home and personal life and your social group was on Facebook, and your professional life was on LinkedIn. But more and more, that's blurring. And people are getting braver about what they put on LinkedIn in an effort to try and reveal the whole self.
Yeah.
You know, I'll help you understand me and who I am.
Exactly.
A bit more.
Exactly. You know, and people are using much more creative content that, you know, used to be the domain of Facebook, as you say, and even YouTube, where people are starting to post videos and you know, vlogs and really link outwards into this more authentic expression. And so, you know, I do remember a conversation years ago with a colleague of mine who said, God, it'd be great if LinkedIn could do something for, you know, the third sector, for charities, you know, like a LinkedIn for social good. And I, you know, at the time I thought, oh yeah, that'd be a great idea. But actually what I find is it's happened. I think it's happening anyway, because it's how people are choosing to engage and use that, you know. So people are now using LinkedIn to find, you know, trustees and pro bono offerings and, you know, and tell stories that aren't just of the big brands, but of NGOs and charities. And I think people are getting a lot more savvy as to how to get their story out there.
Yeah.
But still, in this vast realm of massive content overwhelm, which we do have in our current, you know, westernized society particularly, but globally really, I still come back to the stories that catch people's attention, the stories that really hit you somewhere beyond the mind, you know, they almost like punch you in the stomach, are the stories that are real and raw and really human, you know, and you just feel that, you know, when you read something or you watch something and it just touches you on a cellular level, I feel. You know, I get shivers of truth, I call it, in the book. It's that's a real story. That's coming from a place that's truly, truly authentic. And that's what I aspire to. You know, that's what I know a lot of people aspire to. And that's real power, I think, in our own world, but collectively. Because it's power used on behalf of something more than ourselves. You know, I think it's hard to be narcissistic and come from that really deep place. I haven't seen it yet, certainly. I could be wrong. I'm not going to rule it out, but I haven't seen it yet. And so I think that's how these platforms are going to shift and change, because as our consciousness shifts and changes, our storytelling shifts and changes, and then we start to utilize the technology and the social systems around us in completely different ways. And so, you know, this kind of gets me into the biggest aspect of my work, which is how do we collectively, we, me, many others, create a new modern mythology that's empowering and sustainable, and really honors our interconnection with all of life, and brings us almost right back around to Colorado and the little girl. You know, how do we create a story that unites us rather than separates, and honors our diversity and our unique gifts amongst the unity of the systems that we're now striving to create?
So there's a whole, and it does bring us back to the beginning, doesn't it, in terms of the I, we, right, all of us kind of model. Whereas we've, for decades, looked at, you know, the challenges we face, you know, be the environmental or social, and the narrative around that's been all about Armageddon, doom and gloom, nihilistic, kind of falling off, right, a cliff, which is pain for us, and we run away from it. That's human nature, right? And gradually the narrative at that macro level is shifting.
Yes.
That meta narrative is slowly but surely starting to shift towards more of a flourishing,
yes,
optimistic, humanistic kind of future. And the trick in it now seems to be the kind of, well, how do we translate that to the micro level, to the eye, and what does that mean for how we live our lives? And how we relate,
exactly,
to people, and how we make the choices we make, and how we go with the flow, and you know, follow the,
right,
energy, rather than be so kind of Machiavellian about,
exactly,
everything,
exactly,
and mechanistic about it. I wanted to talk about how you see this relationship between, you know, choosing your way, you know, planning your path, you know, designing your story in a very deliberate, intentional, mm-hmm, sort of way, and balancing that with leaving yourself open to serendipity.
Mm-hmm. Yes, natural magic, as I say quite often.
Yeah, because, you know, it seems to me that some of the best things happen through that serendipity.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. I think it is. It's interesting. There's this natural cycle that goes on. I think when we come through, you know, I call it the metamorphosis stage of the restory cycle, where we, to a degree, the victim in us dies, and we, you know, it's not that we won't fall into victimhood again. We just don't fully believe it anymore, because we've seen the power of our choice and showing up in the world. So, you know, when we move into the later stages of the cycle, which are all about the gifts, so giving our gifts in the world and entering into this, to whatever degree we can, this sense of being interconnected with others, with life, with the systems on our planet. And from there, it becomes almost like an in-breath and an out-breath, a dynamic dance between creation and surrender. Of course, those two being two sides of the same coin, I guess. So, you know, I'm very intentional about the story I create in the world. So I've become much better at learning who I am, what I believe I'm here to do, and my gifts that I give to people. And that helps me learn to say no much better to things, that opportunities that come across my path. Because in saying no, I open up space for saying yes. Now, there's some obvious yeses. You know, some people I meet or I hear about, and I just instinctively know I'm going to work with that person, you know. And sometimes that takes years to unfold. And I'm very intentional about creating pathways to that person. Some of my closest colleagues have come along that way now. Equally, there's complete surprises. And when opportunities come, there's also this process of active surrender. So surrendering who I thought I was here to be, what I thought I was here to do, what I thought I would be, you know, traveling this month, to something new that's coming through. And I guess that's surrendering to an intelligence greater than the one that sits in my brain and my head. And that's, you know, whether we want to call that life or creation or the force or God or whatever we want to call that, I believe there is this greater wisdom of the system of life that's constantly at play. And the only thing that we need to do is really just take a deep breath, pause, and listen. And to whatever degree, you know, the more we can avoid the distractions and temptations of the social world we live in, you know, so getting suckered into our phones, you know, the constant bombardment of media that we have the whole time, the drinking, the smoking, the sex, the eating, the whatever our numbing mechanisms are, the more that we can actually step away from those and create space in our life to truly listen, the more we can surrender to this bigger wisdom that's coming through us. And that's when natural magic, synchronicity, serendipity, whatever you want to call it, starts to stream through with increasing regularity. But equally, you know, I think I was saying earlier, that's not a passive process for me. That's a very active process, because we still need to say yes to the opportunities that are presented and act on them. You know, so this is where I guess storytelling moves into story making. Storytelling, we can still be in the realm of intention and dreams and visions and even business plans. If we want to take it there, you know, this is my projected business this year. Story making is where we actually get out there and start doing things and saying yes to opportunities and connecting with people on LinkedIn and, you know, doing whatever that intuition drives us to do. So I call that inspired action. When we're taking inspired action, we both create our story through our choices, but we also open up to the realm of opportunity that exists when we're in that place.
Looking back and listening to you, you've learned so much about yourself and about human nature, and this thread of rebellion that arcs through your life, you know, which has gone from destructive to incredibly constructive. Where's it heading in terms of your own story making?
That's a great question. I mean, you know, I've been through quite a restorying process myself in the last year to 18 months. And, you know, where that's led me, I guess, is right back around to the beginning again, which it always does to some degree. Having come all the way around the cycle from understanding the story of me to surrendering the story of me in favor of a bigger story of we, I now come right back around to the first stage of the restory cycle, which is the spark, my spark. So now where that leads me is I only say yes to the things that set me on fire and get me excited and the people that come across my path that really feel aligned to my spark. And so I think, you know, what I've noticed in the last year about my gifts is I have this incredible gift to liberate stuck energy in systems, whether that's a personal system and a personal narrative or whether that's a collective system in teams and organizations. And that's a mixed blessing, I can tell you, because some people don't like to be liberated from stuck energy. And so that can be really tough sometimes, but it's also very healing. It's very healing because what doesn't work anymore and what's not serving is given an opportunity to fall away. And so I find myself doing much, much more work with individuals, with key catalysts in these systems and these organizational narratives, and really bringing them on a restorying journey so they can go back into the world of which they're a part and approach it from a very conscious, aware place, you know, and inspire other people to become more conscious and aware of the stories they're making. You know, I take a lot of people out on quests to various parts of the world, often, you know, away from tech, in nature, in very sometimes tough environments, to actually create these senses of space and pause and really reconnect people to their inherent ability to listen to the greatest wisdom they'll ever hear, which is their own. You know, and of course, there's more books in there. There's more books wanting to come through. It's a good job I enjoy writing. It's a good job I enjoy storytelling. Once you started, right? So now I think I won't find that process so scary. Now I've been through it a couple of times. And so, yes, there'll be more offerings coming that way. So I find now, you know, where my work is knowing now my own story of me and my own gifts, allows me to be discerning in terms of how do I place it in service of the biggest story of we on the planet right now for the biggest impact that I can, you know, because there's many, many things we all could do that would all probably add value in their own way. But there's certain situations, certain people, certain choices that you will enter into and everything will change. And the ripple effects of those will come back to you and others for years and years to come. And those are these key catalyst moments in our story and our evolution that, you know, we learn to recognize over time. But you'll have to read the book to find out more about some of those in my world and start to really pay attention in your own world. So, you know, those pivotal moments that left you and others forever changed, those are the biggest clues to your unique narrative.
And sometimes you don't recognize them in the now. You recognize them with hindsight.
Absolutely. And sometimes it takes someone else to mirror them back to you as well. I've had that a lot of times where people go, oh my God, that's amazing. You're like, really? I thought that was just, and then you kind of see it from their perspective. So, you know, the mirror of others is also very powerful in this.
So here's a thought. How would it be if we were to challenge listeners to respond to a question that you want to pose to reveal the most enlightening insights they've had around those kind of catalyst moments or something else? But the choice is yours. You know, what's the question you want to pose to people and what's the reward they might get?
So it's interesting, you know, there's many, many questions in life, but the one I keep coming back to again and again for myself, as well as the one I start almost every workshop with, is the question of who am I? No, who am I really? So that's the question I would like to pose. And I'd like to offer, you know, the 13 signed copies of my book. And 13 is a very special number for me. So 13 copies of my book to listeners who provide the most authentic answer to that. You know, the most.
I love that. I love that. I've got to ask, why 13?
So interestingly,
can you tell us?
I can. So 13 is an unlucky number in our culture quite often. It's funny, it has dogged me. You know, these clues that life gives you, it has followed me my entire life. It's ridiculous. So every single student number I had through school, all of my exam desks, you know, houses I've lived in, 13. It's really funny. My stepson is now born on the 13th of January. You know, 13 is just in my world. And it's a really interesting number in mythology. I won't go into it now because there's lots of layers to that. But if you're interested to find out the true meaning of 13 before we accepted the social story of it being bad luck, then just do a Google search. I launched my new website on the 13th of October last year, Friday the 13th. So I'm a big advocate of restoring 13 as unlucky and actually restoring it back to its original meaning, which is actually, you know, the center point around which everything else revolves. So I'll let people find their own. I'll let people adventure into that in their own way.
Well, I, for one, will, because my eldest son was born on the 13th of November.
Oh, there you go.
So, even if he can't be bothered, I will.
13's a very powerful number.
Brilliant. Okay. Jen, thank you so much for joining us. It's been a delight to talk to you.
Oh, thank you for inviting me. And I suspect there'll be many more of these conversations in the years to come.
Is that a promise? You'll come back?
Absolute promise. That's a provocation. How's that?
Okay. I'm going to make a diary note now. Thanks,
well,
Jen.
Well, thank you.
I'm your host, Tony Cook, and I'm on a mission to provide inspiration and insight for people changing their world. So check out changehackers.org to read show notes, guest blogs, and subscribe to access bonus content. Remember, this show's for you and change hackers like you. So drop me a line, tell me what you love, what you hate, or ideas you have for improving the show. And let me know if you know someone who'd make a great guest on this show. Maybe a friend, someone you work with, maybe even you. Just use the contact form at changehackers.org. I'd love to hear from you. Till next time, change hackers.